Ted Bundy, horrible serial killer, incredibly intelligent man. But one thing he didn't know was that the white van that he had stolen, that he used when he dumped his last victim, dumped her body, had plant fragments caught up on the vehicle, underneath the vehicle. And the investigators were able to identify that material and figure out that it matched plants growing at the crime scene. So it related back to Lockhart's exchange principle. It linked his vehicle to the crime scene. So that's a, and there's a lot, botanical evidence is just part of the case that investigators are building. But, and sometimes it's pretty key evidence, as it was in the Bundy case.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know what you'll uncover. Watch the tide rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this Louisiana night.
We are missing magnolias, and we have a special guest with us here today. We have Dr. David Gibson here to discuss his book, Planting Clues, How Plants Solve Crimes. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on the podcast. I'm looking forward to it.
So where to even begin? Can you, first of all, just describe what is forensic botany?
Well,
and then I'm sure you have a story in there. Can you tell us how your love with plants first began?
Okay. So forensic botany, I think I would say it would be the use of plants that would include fungi, which are not plants, as some sort of evidence in legal cases. That's kind of a broad brush sort of definition. And my love of plants, it's difficult to know where it came from, really. I mean, my mother loved gardening and loved wildflowers. And when I went to university for my undergraduate degree, I was going to do a sort of a biology degree and ended up doing a botany degree, mostly because the botany department I thought was more modern and up-to-date and better than the zoology department that seemed a bit archaic and dusty and had microscopes with mirrors instead of lights and things like that. So ended up on the botany side of things, and it just kind of continued from there.
So your book, and I hope I'm correct in saying this, when we look for, in terms of the forensics, clues from plants, it's either in a microscopic respect or a macroscopic respect. Can you kind of go into the Locard theory and the different ways that we can look at the interactions at a scene?
Yes. So Edmond Locard was a French forensics expert, and he established the first forensics laboratory in Lyon in France in the sort of 1910, 20s and so forth. And it would have been fascinating to meet this man because he seemed to be do a whole lot of different stuff, and he was a writer. He published loads and loads of stuff, all in French, of course. And he is, I don't know if he named it as such, but basically he established this idea that there's a linkage or this exchange principle between, at a crime scene, between the scene, the victim, the suspect, and the evidence being kind of central to all this. And that if you can use some sort of forensic evidence to link a suspect to a crime scene or to a victim, then you're going a long way to getting the sort of evidence you need in the court of law. And so there's a lot, he talked about all sorts of different sorts of evidence. And he talked about organic dusts as being this kind of the small stuff. And he included plants in that sort of evidence. And as far as the macro and the micro is concerned, you could be the sort of evidence, botanical evidence, could be, whole pieces of plants, leaves and things like this, which you can see. But there's also a lot of plant fragments or whole plants that are tiny that we can't see. Pollen, spores of fungi, unicellular diatoms, which are algae, that will be caught up in mud and on people's clothing and in their hair, that criminals or suspects have no idea that they're transporting from a crime scene when they leave it, or they carry it to a crime scene, or it gets from a suspect onto them and so forth. And so the plant evidence can be large things like whole seeds or things that you need a microscope to look at.
Yeah, and you use so many great examples throughout your book. Speaking of some of the more high-profile ones, there's the infamous Ted Bundy case where, I'm sure you can probably go into more detail, where plant fragments were on his tires and his infamous white van that he had stolen. And you also alluded to the Kaylee Anthony case, with the plant litter. Can you go into a little bit more detail on those cases?
Yeah, so those are a couple of good cases because they're high profile cases that people know about. So Ted Bundy, you know, horrible serial killer, incredibly intelligent man. But one of the things he didn't know was that the white van that he had stolen, that he used when he dumped his last victim, dumped her body, had plant fragments caught up on the vehicle, underneath the vehicle. And the investigators were able to identify that material and figure out that it matched plants growing at the crime scene. So related back to Lockhart's exchange principle, it linked his vehicle to the crime scene. So that's and there's a lot, you know, botanical evidence is just part of the case that investigators are building. But, you know, and sometimes it's pretty key evidence, as it was in the Bundy case. In the Casey Anthony case, it's an interesting case. As you and your listeners may know, this is a case where her daughter went missing, was eventually found dead in the woods. They charged the mother. She ended up not being found guilty. So no one was ever found guilty of this crime. But when she was prosecuted, there was some plant evidence that was important. Part of it was when they found the body out in the woods, they wanted to know how long the body had been there, because it's always important to have the timeline of things. And so the defense brought in a forensic botanist called Jane Bock, who said, based upon her expert opinion, the body had been in the woods for 2 weeks. And they said, well, where do you get 2 weeks from? And she said, well, based upon her knowledge of how plants decompose and how they get compressed underneath the body, it would have been about 2 weeks. The prosecution's botanist, another well-known forensic botanist, Hall is his name, said, no, it's much longer than that. So we had two different botanists giving conflicting evidence. And this is a case where it's expert opinion. It's not actual evidence as such. It's the opinion of them in their expert knowledge. So they kind of, in a way, kind of negated each other. There was also some evidence of plant material that was in the trunk of the mother's car. And the prosecution botanist said, well, that's camphor tree. And that ties us to the location where the body was found. But then the defense botanist said, well, there are no camphor trees growing at that scene. So again, there was a difference of opinion between these two botanists. And so I suppose in the end, the defense botanist kind of helped to counter or discredit some of the prosecution's botanist's testimony. So a really kind of a complex, nuanced sort of case where botanical evidence was useful.
Absolutely, yes. And I'm really curious just about that expert testimony process. Like, I did it once for a civil case, and I was terrified the entire time because it's like it all relies on you and your expertise. And you've got all this experience and chops behind it, but it's still, you know, a lot of people listening to what you say, and that matters a whole lot. And that was really scary for me.
Yeah. And of course, the judge can throw that sort of evidence out because there's this standard called the Frye standard that the judge has this discretion to say that you are an expert or not, or your evidence is going to be admitted, you know, as expert testimony. So I'm not surprised you would testify. I've never been called in, but I would be petrified too.
Yeah, it's like you spend all this time talking and you want people to listen, but then also as researchers, we don't speak in certainties. So it's hard to do that too. That would be scary to be in that courtroom, especially if the other expert has a conflicting opinion. Jeez Louise. I would love to talk more about this serial offenders in forensic botany. Like, I am thinking about the offenders that go back and visit the crimes, the dump sites, like the Green River Killer. And I bet, you know, there was a whole lot of that evidence from him visiting the sites where he'd put the bodies over and over and over again. I mean, he eventually confessed and stuff. So we didn't need that. But like, I bet that would have been really compelling evidence. And I wonder if they have anything like that on Lisk, the Long Island serial killer, because we were wondering whether or not he was visiting their remains.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I don't know about in those cases, but there was the case, the Bundy tree case, where they were looking for one of his victims out in the mountains in Utah. And they came across a tree where someone had carved into the tree something like Ted Bundy 1978 or something like that. And the initial thought was that Bundy had gone back and kind of marked the tree as some sort of, not trophy, but, you know, something like you're talking about. But when botanists looked at it, they realized that the way the tree had been carved, the depth of the carving hadn't gone that deep. It just kind of got the skin or the bark of the tree, and it kind of grown back around it. And they could count the kind of growth rings of growth back to show that that carving had been made in 1978. Well, Bundy had been arrested in February of 1978. So it's very unlikely that he had actually made that carving. And they actually asked him about it. And he said no. Whether you believe him or not, it's difficult to know. But the thought was it was probably somebody else just gone out there and put it on there, and it wasn't actually related to a dump site that he may have been going back to.
Yeah, you had another great example involving wood too, where it was kind of, could it have been a suicide or a lynching? And can you talk more about that case, where how the wood was growing was indicative of that time frame? And
yeah, so that case was where they found a skeleton at the base of a tree. And of course, they wanted to know whether someone had been, and high up in the tree, there was a T-shirt that was around a branch. And they thought, well, had someone been hung and died, murdered by hanging, or was this a suicide? And first thought was that the height of the noose from the shirt up in the tree was indicative of how long ago it had been. The idea, as the tree grows, it'd be put on a low branch initially, and as the tree grows, the branch would move up and everything. Well, that's not how trees grow, for a start. Trees grow from the tips. The new growth is from the tips. So if you put something on a branch or you bang a nail into the side of a tree, it's not going to move up as a tree grows. So it just doesn't happen. So that shirt must have been put up on that branch at that height in the first place. And then when they looked at it, they found that the bark of that branch had grown around the shirt a little bit, and they could kind of get some idea of how long. I think it's like 5 years or something. So from the growth rings around the part of the shirt. And so what they finally decided was that the tree, when it was spindly and young, like a sapling, that the person had been able to bend it down, put the T-shirt on, wrap it around their neck, let go, pulls them back up, and suicide, hangs them. So they decided in the end it was a suicide and not a hanging. But here again, it's interesting that it's, you know, the botanical evidence wasn't so much the presence of plant parts or anything. It was just knowledge of the way plants grow. And the initial thought, you know, like I said, was based upon incorrect knowledge of how trees grow. The idea that things move up as trees grow, which is botanically wrong.
That's fascinating. I mean, the nerd in me who wants to learn everything is like, my mind is blown on this. Trees are our record keepers too. I mean, I'm probably pulling from my knowledge of the X-Files, but nonetheless, you know, they're secretly keeping our records.
They are indeed, yes. Yes, trees don't lie.
Another example, you know, Michelle and I had covered some suspicious deaths at Lady Bird Lake. I don't know if you've heard in the news about, there's been a lot of drownings in Austin, but we were very interested in how an autopsy and a drowning can look different than something more nefarious. You mentioned a really interesting case about the murder in the Hudson River where diatoms had entered into her lungs. Can you explain how kind of water affects kind of the evidence?
Yes. So yeah, this is really fascinating, this idea here. The diatoms are unicellular algae, tiny little microscopic algae, single cells. And the cells have basically a glass wall, a silica wall around them. So they're very resistant to decay. You know, you can boil them up in acid and the glass is still there and you can find them. And in the case of drownings, is that when these algae are in all freshwater bodies, lakes, rivers, streams, and so forth. And there's a lot of different sorts of species. So the different sorts of species are very indicative of location for a start. But in terms of drowning, when someone drowns, you know, they get water in their lungs, part of the drowning, because they're trying to breathe in air and they're getting water instead. But when a dead body is dumped into some water, water will enter the lungs. And you'll find diatoms. And if the diatoms are the same as in the body of water, that means that it's from that location and not moved elsewhere. But if a body drowns, then those last gasps trying to breathe are so powerful that the water and what's in it microscopically gets through the alveoli in the lungs and into the bloodstream. And, you know, the blood is still moving around the body at that point before the heart stops. And diatoms will be carried around in the bloodstream in those last few seconds and deposited in the major organs like liver and in the bone marrow. So if on autopsy they find diatoms in bone marrow in a drowning victim, that means that that victim must have drowned in the water and not just been dumped in the water. Because if they're just dumped in the water, it doesn't get past the lungs. So that's a really key piece of evidence. And in the murder in the Hudson River, it was even more complicated than that, because they found a body and, you know, they wanted to know what happened. And they found some strangulation marks on the woman's neck. They found drugs in her bloodstream. But they found diatoms in her bone marrow. So, of course, they went to the closest relative, which was her boyfriend, and said, "What's going on?" He said, "Nothing." But then there was a nephew, apparently, who confessed, I suppose, as an accomplice, probably to get a lesser sentence or something. And he said, apparently what happened was that the boyfriend wanted to get rid of the girlfriend. And so he drugged her. And he took what he thought was the body out to the Hudson River and threw it in. But she revived. And so there she was, coming to in the water. So he went into the water and strangled her in the water. So she died of strangulation and drowning. So she was drowning in the water. He was strangling her and so forth. So when they found the body, that's why they had the drugs and the strangulation and the diatoms. They also found diatoms on some personal articles of hers that were scattered around the body, confirming the location and everything. And so he was found guilty. But the diatoms in this case were key evidence indicating the method of death and the location of death.
Absolutely fascinating. It reminds me of we have a case here in Louisiana, the Jennings 8 or the West Davis 8, West Jefferson Davis Parish 8, something like that. 8 women whose remains were found in a small community of Jennings, and the cases are all unsolved. There's been speculation that somebody in law enforcement, because there was some pretty sketchy law enforcement behavior going on, but we don't even know if it's a serial killer or not. However, a lot of the women had a history of substance abuse problems. A couple of them were found deceased in waterways, and there were drugs in their system. And they ended up marked undetermined as manner of death because of the context of what was going on. So that makes me wonder, you know, what kind of stuff they found in the process. And learning this, I think it helps us realize that as people who are consuming crime news, we don't have all of the details that law enforcement has. And so sometimes we say things like, that could never be a suicide, or that was definitely foul play, but we don't know the inner workings of how it is to drown and what evidence exists there versus strangulation and those kinds of things. And I think the example you gave is a perfect example of how, you know, if you don't know all of the facts or understand those things, it's easy to assume things are far more, you know, maybe deviant, or the police are covering it up, those kind of things that we say. We probably feel that more because we just don't understand, you know?
Yeah. But on the other hand, you have to wonder, I mean, in the case you mentioned, have they looked for diatoms in the bone marrow of these women to find out if they did actually drown?
Probably not.
Well, you know, and this is part of the things I talk about in the book, is that I think that in many cases, crime scene investigators aren't trained enough in botany to recognize that there may be some important evidence. You know, exactly. They're going to have to outsource it because they're not going to be trained to identify things. And when they do, I mean, the cases that I talk about are all great cases, but it's just they're probably cases where the investigators did recognize there was some evidence that they should look for botanically.
You're absolutely right. You have to know what to look for. And it's such a critical time, you know, that evidence can be just lost forever if you don't make those smart choices right in the beginning. And I think about the insight, you know, those detectives had in the 40s and 50s to collect DNA when they didn't even know that it was going to be meaningful, you know? So there are definitely some really smart people out there, even if they don't understand it, preserving that important evidence.
Speaking of what may be more accessible to them, can you talk about the greening effect and what's kind of visible in terms of vegetation when a body is buried?
Well, yeah. So when a body is buried, then it's going to decompose. And, you know, bodies have a whole lot of nutrients in them and a lot of nitrogen. So as that decomposes, first of all, there's a lot of caustic acids released, and that's going to kind of poison the soil and poison anything growing above it. So there's this kind of halo effect apparently around it, either a dump body or even a buried body. But after a period of time, those nutrients from the body will be released, mineralized, and become available for plant growth. And so the plants then that will colonize or grow on the soil above a body will have a whole lot of good stuff to grow. And so they will grow very lush. And when plants get fertilized, they tend to be greener. That's a thing you see. If you fertilize your lawn, it'll look greener. It could be that a buried body, there's various ways to look for buried bodies. And one thing that could help would be looking for kind of green patches of vegetation. There's a lot of green vegetation here. Maybe this is where the body is, and we can use some other methods to investigate it. So that's how that arises from a buried body.
Is there a difference in vegetation between a body above the dirt and under the ground? So if I dump a body versus bury it, is it going to look different?
I think so. I think it's going to. We don't know too much about this. This hasn't been looked at too much. But when a body is buried, you know, they've got to dig a hole, throw the body in, and put the soil back on top. And so that soil is highly disturbed at that point. Is going to decompose in situ. There's going to be the whole decomposition thing going on and breakdown of the body. And it may take a little bit longer for plants to kind of recolonize that toxic island where the body was. But they'll eventually grow in from the sides and so forth. We don't know too much about that to have it been used much yet so far.
I was thinking about a previous interview we had done with the vulture expert, and she was telling us about how they study decomposition and how they can't really create the same environment as natural, as what occurs naturally when people are decomposing out in the nature. Because there are all kind of issues about ethics. You can't just put a body out there and then the neighbor next door finds an arm later, you know? Like, you can't let the animals actually scavenge in that way of a human body. So this, to understand, there's a lot that we still don't really understand about what happens out there in the natural world, because, of course, we can't perfectly replicate that in science.
Well, yes. In fact, I listened to the interview this morning. Waiting for this, it was fascinating because I saw the title. I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting, and it really was on the vultures. And so she mentioned the body farms, as they're euphemistically called. There's a more complex term that's used for them. But those are some cases where these so-called body farms, and we have one at my institution, Southern Illinois University has one, and the famous one down in Knoxville in Tennessee, and there's others around the country and around the world, where they do, in a secure facility, they do put out bodies on the ground, and some they bury, and the emphasis of those has been on looking at the breakdown of the body. And yes, they tend to put a fence around the bodies that they put on the ground because they don't want an animal carrying off an arm out of the facility that gets found in the public. That would not be good. So there is that limitation that any body breakdown doesn't include really the scavenging activities of vultures or other animals. But they are very useful facilities for looking at breakdown the body. And in our facility, we've got a faculty member that called Gretchen Dabbs, who has been looking at the fungi that are colonizing the skin of a body that's put above the ground, because the bodies will break down, but in some climates where it's not as warm and humid as perhaps you have, the drier air will dry out the skin. It'll break down a little bit slower, and that provides some time for fungi to colonize the skin. And there may be certain sorts of fungi that colonize the skin that could allow investigators to get an idea of the post-mortem interval, how long it's been since the body died. Because if you find a certain species growing on the skin that doesn't colonize for, say, 2 weeks, that gives you a timing, much like they use insect emergence from corpses to get an idea of the timing, the PMI. So there's some definite possibilities of botanical evidence being involved in this sort of investigation from evidence from these body farms.
Darkcast Network, indie pods with a dark side.
And there have been a lot, I don't know the exact numbers, but just by us talking to people and reading in the true crime world, those mushroom hunters are finding bodies all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of cadaver fungi is again, not well, clearly known. Scientifically, the fungi I was talking about were more the not so much the mushroom producing ones, but the kind that just grow over the surface. But yeah, there's some definite possibilities that certain species of fungi could be indicative of bodies, but of course they're going to be fungi saprophytes, so they're getting nourishment from dead materials, mostly from wood. So just because you find a one of these sorts of fungi doesn't mean to say it's a body, but they could be a body.
So you briefly mentioned PMI. Can we talk more about how a time frame is determined? You mentioned some really great examples with stomach contents.
Yes, PMI, post-mortem interval, how long it's been since the body died. And the thing about stomach contents is that when someone dies, the valves, the sphincters, top and the bottom of the stomach close up. And so what's in the stomach when someone dies remains in the stomach. The anal sphincter tends to open up, so body will void itself, soil itself when it's dying. So looking at some contents can be really revealing in terms of knowing what someone ate at their last meal, because that's sitting in their stomach, if it's, you know, within a certain time period. And so this sort of evidence was pioneered by someone called Jane Bock from the University of Colorado. In one of the cases, you know, that they had a body of a young woman, and they wanted to know more about, you know, the timing of her death. And so they took some of the stomach contents that had plant materials in them, and they asked her to identify them. And when she did, she literally took them and put them on a microscope slide and looked to see what they were, looked at comparison samples to match things up. And she found that the stomach contents didn't match what they knew about the woman's last meal, because they knew she'd had lunch with her boyfriend. So the boyfriend's an obvious suspect. But the stomach contents didn't match. So she must have had a second meal later. And that helped provide some idea of the timing of events leading to her death, and also tied it into the suspect that they eventually got, because they found that he had sort of knew her and took her out for a meal before he took her away and killed her. And so the stomach contents from that last meal tied her to the restaurant, I think it was a Wendy's or something, where she'd eaten and what had been on the salad bar from the meal she'd had.
Wow. It's just the level of detail. And the other example, the victim had consumed fig seeds as his last meal.
Yeah, this is less certain, but in Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, they saw a fig tree growing out of a kind of a hole in the ground above a cave. And they went down and found a body down there. And it was from a man who had gone missing several years ago, who was a resistance fighter at the time. And it was known that he liked eating figs. And in fact, from his last meal, he'd been in a restaurant eating some figs or something. And so the presence of this fig tree provided a clue that there might be something going on. And the thought was that he'd been dumped in his cave, and the figs in his stomach, when his body decomposed, had germinated and grown, and a tree had grown out through a hole in the top of the cave. And so it's kind of an amusing, somewhat anecdotal story, but it's possible. It's very possible that, you know, if you consume some seeds and your body's been there lying there long enough and decomposes, those seeds are going to germinate and grow. And so that could be a visual clue that there's a body there, as in this apparent case.
So our parents were right. If you eat a watermelon seed, a watermelon will grow in your stomach. If you're dead.
Yeah. I don't think I'll go right away.
So this is going to be, I'm going to be way above me. So can we talk about DNA? How challenging is it when there's someone's trying to match seeds at a crime scene to a victim? How does one tree determine, is it different enough in the DNA? Can you kind of, I know that's a big area.
It can be. I mean, when you're looking at DNA, and of course, human DNA is well established in cases, and there's kind of two levels of looking at DNA. At one level, you can look at the DNA and do tests, DNA tests, to see what species something is. And for humans, though, we know it's human DNA. We want to know which individual it's from. So that's kind of a whole more detailed level of DNA testing. But it works for plants as well. And so the first case of that was a so-called Maricopa case, Maricopa County, where Phoenix is in Arizona, way back in 1992, and at a time when human DNA was accepted into courts of law, but plant DNA had not been admitted in a court before. And in this case, they found a body of a young woman, and she was underneath a tree, it's called Palo Verde tree, which is a very common desert plant. And they got a suspect, and they wanted to try and tie the suspect to the crime scene. And they found in the bed of his pickup truck some seed pods of a Palo Verde tree. Well, that doesn't really tie him to the tree that the body was found under, because there's Palo Verde trees all over that area. So it's a very common tree. So that didn't help too much. but they did some DNA analysis and to look not just were these seed pods from Palo Verde trees, but were they from the same tree under which the body was found? And when they did the DNA analysis, they found that it was. The DNA of the seed pods in the bed of the truck matched the same tree under which the body was found and didn't match other trees of the same species nearby. And that DNA evidence was accepted into to the court as evidence and helped convict the perpetrator of that crime. So that's the first time. And since then, you know, that this sort of evidence can be used just like human evidence. And it can be used for crimes like this, but it's also can be important for like poaching cases to find out where people have poached things from and so forth.
So we haven't even yet begun to talk about poisons. How hard in the toxicology report is it to detect certain kinds of poisons that are plant-based?
Well, it depends upon the poison. And I think, you know, when someone is suspected of being poisoned, unless there's some clear evidence, you know, from their home that they drank a tea with some yew leaves in it or something, then they have to look at the symptomology of how the person died. And in certain things like strychnine poisoning, it can be pretty obvious because of the way the muscles contract in the body and the way the body contorts with strychnine poisoning. So then they would suspect there was strychnine. So they could do a chemical test for strychnine. But if they don't know, then they got a problem. I mean, there's certain things they can test for that they know, you know, strychnine and belladonna, atropine, and things like that are kind of well-established plant poisons. So there's chemical tests for all those sorts of things. But there may be cases where it's some unusual plant that is going to be more difficult. I mean, it's not that they can't test chemically; it's they don't know what to test for. Could be the problem.
So you had a mid chapter on Agatha Christie, who was kind of the queen of plant poisons. I don't know if you've ever contemplated, but if you had to pick a favorite plant of poison for someone, what would it be?
What would I use? Well, I don't want to give people ideas here, but but there's a lot of common plants that we see every day that are pretty poisonous that, you know, someone could use and have used, you know, and that Agatha Christie talks about. I mean, mostly her books are the cases where someone is poisoned. It, early on in the book, they work out what the poison was, and then it was a case of who did it. That's kind of how she wrote the books. But some of the common things that can be used, I mean, like yew tree leaves. Yew trees are poisonous. There's only one part of the plant that's not poisonous. That's apparently the red around the arrow that's called that grows around the seed. Apparently that's not, but I wouldn't want to try it myself either. But it apparently doesn't take too many leaves, and people have done this. They've made tea out of yew tree, either accidentally or on purpose for suicide. And so that is a pretty good poison that you could use, I suppose. But you want something, if you're trying to poison someone, you want something that's not going to show up too quickly. And so something is give, you know, very characteristic symptomology that is going to give the game away pretty quickly. Other things less so. So it's not easy to choose a plant poison, I would say.
So we've talked about, you know, how useful in terms of an investigation, how plant forensics can be, but you also in the book mention how it's useful to have more knowledge for farmers, for the layperson in terms of what medicines we're ingesting, what supplements we're taking, even how, you know, it would border patrol, it would be useful for them to know what kinds of things people are smuggling across the border. So in your opinion, what can we do better? What needs to change?
I mean, you know, my view as a botanist is that everyone needs to know more about plants to counter what we call plant blindness, the idea that plants are just all the same thing. There's green things that grow around. But yeah, I think it would be, as I mentioned before, it'd be really useful for border control agents, for crime scene investigators, just to know the sort of evidence that they could be looking for. You know, for crime scene investigations, the idea that there could be plant evidence that might be important, that at least recognize that they should get it checked out. For border control agents, it's really difficult because they're looking to find people that are bringing things into the country that they shouldn't be bringing in. And of course, drugs, which are plant-based, and there's a battery of chemical tests that they can use, presumptive tests, to kind of get an idea if someone's carrying something that they shouldn't be. But in terms of poached plants, like rare orchids that are stolen out of nature reserves in the wild, in tropical countries, bringing in plants that are really, really rare, it's really hard because the smugglers are not going to bring in an orchid in a pot with a nice, beautiful flower on it. They're going to bring it in when it doesn't have a flower on it. And most orchids look the same without flowers. They've got a couple of, you know, strap-like kind of greenish leaves. And so it's really, really hard. And the smugglers tend to mix in the rare plants with common plants that they have a permit to bring in. And so it's really hard. And then things like wood that is poached out of rainforest and turned into furniture. By the time it might be coming into, say, the United States, it's not going to be a big trunk. It's going to be, you know, planed down and put into a piece of furniture. So they just have to kind of try and look for these things and then pass them off for testing. And for the orchids, probably going to have to be DNA tests because you really can't tell them. For timber and things like that, you can do some microscopic tests, and that's getting more and more sophisticated with like machine learning methodologies that allows them to look at things and figure out the characteristics and see if it matches something. Or some DNA tests. And there's been cases where people have had a permit to bring in wood from one country, but they're actually bringing in the same species from a different country where they didn't have a permit, where they'd smuggled it. And it took advanced testing to figure that out. But it's possible, but it's just a question of being more aware of what they should be looking for, I think.
And you make me think of also us everyday humans and issues with invasive species. I know here, to bring it back to Lady Bird Lake, they were talking about how the lake is unsafe to swim in for a number of reasons, including I don't know exactly what it is, but in a plant that's invasive, that's not indigenous, and that's kind of taken over the waterways and making it difficult for people to like swim freely. So there's a higher risk of drowning because of that. And here in Louisiana, we have if you're paying attention, you hear a lot about invasive plant species kind of messing things up. But I think most of us humans are not actively listening to those kinds of things. Would you have any advice or things we should be paying attention to, areas of concern, things like that for us regular?
Well, yeah, and it's certainly true that botanists are well aware of the invasive species that are occurring. And I assume you've got kudzu and water hyacinth and things like that are in your waterways. And, you know, botanists are well aware of that. But and for the most part, land managers are too. The difficulty is controlling them once they escape into the wild. You know, it's stopping them in the first place and, you know, working with the ornamental industry and horticulture industry so that they're not selling things that could become invasive. That's really important. And there's organizations that do that. But as far as the public is concerned, they can, if they're interested, they can join and volunteer to help out with land conservation agencies and nature preserves and to help work days to remove invasive species as a volunteer. So there's a lot of need for people to get involved if they're interested in helping out.
And just to plug, the Acadiana Nature Station here in Lafayette is always looking for volunteers. And if us local listeners haven't been there, you should give it a go because it's very cool and beautiful. And they have an albino snake.
Before we wrap today, is there anything else you're working on? How is retirement going?
Retirement's nice. It means I can do what I like when I like to a large extent. I mean, I still have some grad students I'm working with to get them finished up, but I'm still working on a grassland book, an academic book, but I'm kind of turning onto some fiction writing. I'm trying to write a novel, and people tell me I should write a forensic crime story, but it's not how it's turning out, but maybe I will my next one.
Yeah, book number two, three.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
Well, thank you so much for your time. This was fascinating. I learned a whole lot, and I think that our listeners are going to appreciate learning all these interesting plant facts.
Yeah. And thank you very much. And tell your students, you know, when you, I don't know if there are plant evidence classes that in the law school that you teach in, but
there should be.
There should be. Okay. Yeah. I know we have one here in our law school, and they invited me at one point to come in and talk to their evidence class about forensic botany that they wouldn't have otherwise heard about, I think.
Michelle's university has a bayou in the middle of the campus. So
yeah.
Lots of potential.
Yeah. Turtle. We have a swamp, turtles, alligators, and all kind of indigenous plants. So who knows what we're cooking up in there?
You don't know. Yeah. I used to be at University of West Florida in Pensacola, and they also have a bayou on their campus with alligators and things.
You know what it's like in the swamps.
I do. Yes. I try to keep out of it.
Smart.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I look forward to hearing the edited version of our conversation.